Just inside the gate stood a small village of a dozen buildings made of corrugated sheet sections of the Quonset type. They, too, were set out in a street of military precision. A big, well-organized outfit, Nicholas commented. Let's go down and see who's in charge. There were two armed guards on the gate, dressed in the camouflage uniform of the Ethiopian army. They were clearly surprised by the arrival at the gate of the strange land cruiser, and when Nicholas sounded his horn, one of them came forward suspiciously with his AK-47 rifle at the ready. I want to speak to the manager here, Nicholas told him in Arabic, with enough haughty authority to make the sentry uncertain and uneasy. The soldier grunted, went back and consulted his colleague, then lifted the handset of the two-way radio and spoke earnestly into the mouthpiece. There was a 5-minute delay after he finished speaking, and then the door of the nearest Quonset building opened and a white man came out. He was dressed in khaki coveralls and a soft bush cap. His eyes, covered by mirrored sunglasses, were set in a deeply tanned, leathery face. His physique was short and chunky, and his sleeves were rolled up over hairy, work-thickened arms. After speaking a few words to the guards at the gate, he came out to the Toyota. "Yeah? What's going down here?" he demanded in a Texan drawl, speaking around the stub of an unlit cigar. "The name's Quentin Harper." Nicholas dismounted from the truck to greet him and held out his hand. "Nicholas Quentin Harper, how do you do?" The American hesitated, and then took the hand as though he had been offered an electric eel to squeeze. "Helm," he said. "Jake Helm from Abilene, Texas. I'm the foreman here." His hand was that of an artisan, with calloused palms and lumpy scar tissue over the knuckles and half moons of black grease under the fingernails. "Terribly sorry to worry you. I'm having some trouble with my truck. I wondered if you had a mechanic who could have a look at it for me." Nicholas smiled winningly, but received no encouragement from the man. "Not company policy," he shook his head. "I'm prepared to pay for any—" "Listen, buddy, I said no." Jake removed the cigar from his mouth and examined it minutely. "Your company, Pegasus, can you tell me where your head office is situated? Who is your managing director?" "I'm a busy man. You're wasting my time." Helm returned the cigar to his mouth and began to turn away. "I will be hunting in this area over the next few weeks. I'd not like to endanger any of your employees with a stray shot. Can you give me some idea of where you'll be working?" "I'm running a prospecting outfit here, mister. I don't give out news flashes on my movements. Beat it." He turned and walked to the gate, and gave brisk orders to the guards before marching back to his office building. "Satellite disc on the roof," Nicholas remarked. "I wonder who our lad Jake is speaking to at this very moment."
"Somebody in Texas?" Royan hazarded.
"Doesn't follow necessarily," Nicholas demurred. "Pegasus is probably a multinational. Just because Jake is one doesn't mean his boss is Texan also. Not a very instructive conversation, I'm afraid." He started the engine and U-turned the Toyota. "But if someone at Pegasus is the ugly mixed up in this, he will recognize my name. We have given them notice of our arrival. Let's see what we flushed out of the bushes." When they got back to the Dandera River Falls, they found that Boris's truck had arrived, the tents had been erected, and the chef had brewed tea for them. Boris was less welcoming than his chef, and maintained a sullen silence while Nicholas tried to placate him for commandeering his truck. It was only after his first vodka of the evening that he mellowed sufficiently to speak again. "The mules were supposed to be waiting for us here. Time means nothing to these people. We cannot start down into the gorge until they arrive." "Well, at least while we're waiting for them, I'll have a chance to sight in my rifle," Nicholas remarked with resignation. "In Africa, it never pays to be in a hurry. Too wearing on the nerves." After a leisurely breakfast the next morning, when there was still no sign of the mules, Nicholas fetched his rifle case. When Nicholas lifted the weapon out of its nest of green baize, Boris took it from him and examined it minutely.
"An old rifle?" Made in 1926, Nicholas nodded. My grandfather had it made for himself. They knew how to make them in those days. Not like the mass-produced crap they turn out today. Boris pursed his lips critically. Short Mauser-Obendorf double square bridge action. Beautiful. But it has been rebarreled, no? The original barrel was shot out. I had it replaced with a Schillen match barrel. It will shoot the wings of a mosquito at 100 paces. Caliber 7x57, is it? Boris asked. 275 Rigby, as a matter of fact, Nicholas corrected him. But Boris snorted. It's exactly the same cartridge. Just your English bloodiness must call it something else. He grinned. It will push a 150-grain bullet out there at 2,800 feet per second. It is a good rifle. One of the best. You will never know, my dear fellow, how much your approval means to me, Nicholas murmured in English, and Boris chuckled as he handed the rifle back to him. English jokes. I love your English jokes. When Nicholas left camp carrying the little rifle in its slipcase, Royan followed him down to the river and helped him fill two small canvas bags with white river sand. He laid them on top of a convenient rock, and they formed a firm but malleable rest for the rifle as he settled it over them. Using the open hillside as a safe backdrop, he stepped out 200 yards and at that range set up a cardboard carton on which he had taped a Bisley-type target. He came back to where Royan waited and then settled down behind the rock on which the weapon lay. Royan was unprepared for the report of the first shot from the dainty, almost feminine-looking rifle. She jumped involuntarily, and her ears sang. "What a horrible, vicious thing!" she exclaimed. "How can you bring yourself to kill lovely animals with a high-powered gun like that?" she demanded. "Rifle," he corrected her, as he noted the strike of the shot through his binoculars. "Would it make you feel better if I used a low-powered rifle, or beat them to death with a stick?" The shot had struck 3 inches right and 2 inches low. As he adjusted the telescopic sight, he attempted to explain. An ethical hunter does everything in his power to kill as swiftly and as cleanly as it is possible, and that means stalking in as close as he is able to, using a weapon of adequate power, and sighting it the best way he knows how. His next shot struck exactly on line, but only an inch above the bullseye. He wanted it to shoot 3 inches high at that range. He worked on the sight again. "Gun or rifle, but I don't understand why you want to deliberately kill any of God's creatures," she protested. "Oh, that I can never explain to you." He aimed deliberately and fired once. Even through the lower magnification of the sight lens, he could see that the bullet had struck exactly 3 inches high. "It is something to do with an atavistic urge that few men, no matter how cultured and civilized they deem themselves, can deny completely," he fired a second time. "Some of them work it out in the boardroom, others on the golf course or tennis court, and some of us on a salmon river, in the ocean deeps, or in the hunting field." He fired a third shot, merely to confirm the previous two, and then went on. "As for God's creatures, he gave them to us. You are the believer. Quote me Acts 10, verses 12 and 13. "Sorry," she shook her head. "You tell me. All manner of four-footed beasts of the earth and wild beasts, and creeping things and fowls of the air," Nicholas obliged her. "And there came a voice to him, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.'" "You should have been a lawyer," she moaned in mock despair. "Or a priest," he suggested, and went forward to retrieve the target. He found that his last three shots had punched a tiny symmetrical rosette 3 inches above the bull, all three bullet holes just touching each other. He patted the buttstock of the little rifle. "That's my lovely darling Lucretia Borgia." He had named the rifle for her beauty and for her murderous potential. He slid the rifle back into its leather slipcase, and they walked back together. As they came in sight of the camp, Nicholas pulled up short. "Visitors," he said, and raised his binoculars. "Aha! We have flushed something out of the undergrowth. That is a Pegasus truck parked there, and unless I am much mistaken, one of our visitors is the charming laddie from Abilene. Let's go down and find out what's going on. As they drew closer to camp, they realized that there were a dozen or more heavily armed, uniformed soldiers clustered around the red and green Pegasus truck, and that Jake Helm and an Ethiopian army officer were seated under the awning of the dining tent in serious and intent conversation with Boris. As soon as Nicholas entered the tent, Boris introduced him to the bespectacled Ethiopian officer.
"This is Colonel Tumanogo, the military commander of the southern Gojam region."
"How do you do?" Nicholas greeted him, but the colonel ignored the pleasantry. "I want to see your passport and your firearms license," he ordered arrogantly, while Jake Helm chewed complacently on the evil-smelling butt of an extinguished cigar. "Yes, of course," Nicholas agreed, and went to his own tent to fetch his briefcase. He opened it on the dining table and smiled at the officer. "I'm sure you will also want to see my letter of introduction from the British Foreign Secretary in London, and this one from the British Ambassador in Addis Ababa. Here is another from the Ethiopian Ambassador to the Court of St. James. And this firman is from your own Minister of Defence, General Sia Abraha." The colonel stared in consternation at this fruit salad of ornate official letterheads and scarlet beribboned seals. Behind the gold-rimmed glasses, his eyes were bemused and confused.
"Sir," he jumped to his feet and saluted, "you are a friend of General Abraha? I did not know. Nobody informed me. I beg your pardon for this intrusion."
He saluted again, and his embarrassment made him awkward and ungainly.
"I came to warn you only that the Pegasus Company is conducting drilling and blasting operations. There may be some danger. Please be alert. Also, there are many bandits and outlaws, Shufta, operating in the area."
Colonel Nogo was flustered and barely coherent. He stopped and drew a deep breath to steady himself.
"You see, I have been ordered to provide an escort for the employees of the Pegasus Company. If you yourself experience any trouble while you are here, or if you need assistance for any reason, you have only to call on me, sir."
"That is extremely civil of you, Colonel."
"I will detain you no longer, sir."
He saluted a third time and backed off towards the Pegasus truck, taking the Texan foreman along with him. Jake Helm had not uttered a word since their arrival, and now he left without a farewell. Colonel Nogo gave Nicholas his fourth and final salute through the cab window as the truck pulled away.
"Deuce," Nicholas told Ryan, as he acknowledged the salute with a nonchalant wave. "I think that point was definitely ours. Now at least we know that for whatever reason Mr. Pegasus definitely does not want us in his hair. I think we can expect his next service fairly promptly."
They walked back to where Boris sat in the dining tent, and Nicholas told him,
"All we need now are your mules."
"I have sent three of my men to the village to find them. They should have been here yesterday."
The mules arrived early the next morning, six big sturdy animals, each accompanied by a driver dressed in the ubiquitous jodhpurs and shawl. By mid-morning they were loaded and ready to begin the descent into the gorge. Boris paused at the head of the pathway and looked out over that valley. For once even he seemed to be subdued and awed by the immensity of the drop and the rugged splendour of the gorge.
"You will be passing into another land in another age," he warned them, in an uncharacteristically philosophical mood. "They say that this trail is 2,000 years old. As old as Christ." He spread his hands in a deprecating gesture. "The old black priest in the church at Deborah Mariam will tell you that the Virgin Mary passed this way when she fled from Israel after the crucifixion." He shook his head. "But then these people will believe anything." And he stepped out onto the pathway. It clung to the cliff, descending at such an angle that each pace was down a rock step so deep that it stretched the tendons and sinews in their groins and knees and jarred their spines. They were forced to use their hands to scramble the rougher and steeper sections, where it was almost as though they were descending a ladder.
It seemed impossible that the mules, under their heavy packs, could follow them down. The plucky beasts lunged down each of the rock steps, landing heavily on their forelegs, then gathered themselves for the next drop. The trail was so narrow that the bulky pack scraped against the rock wall on one hand, while on the other hand the drop sucked at them giddily.